Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater, and your moderator for this morning. Today is Sunday, July 26, 2026. The share ID numbers for Friday, July 24th are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,663, that's 23663. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 23,664, that's 23664. This morning, A Vision for You presents Stop Fighting. All of us have come to the program, Overeaters Anonymous, as a result of the suffering, frustration, and despair we experience in our disease of compulsive overeating. Beaten into a state of reasonableness, we come to the realization that we are doomed. For many of us, this realization is the foundation of recovery. It is the point where we stop fighting and stop relying on our own thinking to solve a problem that our own thinking absolutely cannot solve. The purpose of the Big Book is to change your life through a 12-step process of personal transformation, leading to a spiritual awakening, a personality change sufficient to overcome compulsive overeating. If you're suffering from compulsive overeating, the Big Book provides clear directions as to how you can experience such an awakening. Those of us who have walked this path can assure you of its effectiveness. We once suffered in hopelessness and despair. Pain was the greatest motivator to effectuate change. As the Big Book states, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. And of course, for us, even food. Now we are new people with a new purpose. We have been transformed. The problem has been removed. We're no longer fighting. We have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. Recovery began where resistance ended. Joining us today to elaborate on the topic of stop fighting is Ore B, recovered compulsive overeater from Texas. Ore is dedicated to our 12-step way of life, recently celebrating 10 years of recovery, and it's with great appreciation that I welcome Ore to the line. Good morning, Ore. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. Can I be heard?
Yes.
Awesome. Awesome. Just want to make sure I'm coming in loud and clear. Let me set my clock here. My name is Ore. I'm a compulsive overeater. And thank you, Leah. That was a great introduction. And thank God. Thank God that I'm here this morning sharing with y'all instead of being at an In-N-Out. In-N-Out opens at 11 in the West Coast. So I would probably be up at a 7-Eleven getting several packs of cookies. And that was like my pregame to hold me over until In-N-Out opened at 11. Or I'd be stalking the streets in the wee hours of the morning, trying to find the biggest breakfast burrito. That's quite the transformation. I mean, that was my everyday ritual, and on the weekends especially. And, you know, later on in the evening, I would be filled with dread with the realization that I would have to return to work tomorrow. Man, it was, I'm just thinking about that, how, you know, that walk from my parking structure to my office. It was a gauntlet, and it was hard. It was so hard. And I used to wear this dingy jacket, the same dingy jacket and jeans, the jeans that were rubbing out in the middle of the legs. And I had this jacket on thinking that I could somehow cover, you know, my weight, how big I was getting. What it really was I was trying to cover up the shame of it. And from that walk to, from my parking structure to my office, or actually it was to the elevator, I would be so out of breath. Like my heart would be beating out of my chest. And God forbid someone stepped into that elevator with me and saw me already beginning to perspire from less than 7 minute walk. But you know, it's hard to carry 485 pounds. Like life is physically exhausting. And that walk, I would be so out of breath by the time that I got to my seat. Like I felt like I was about to die every morning. Some mornings, you know, I couldn't confront that hell and I would just call in fat, you know, and I just wouldn't show. And I would just extend that binge by one more day and extend that hell by one more day. Eventually, I would have to go in. So, you know, well, first off, let me. I didn't plan to start out with that heaviness. Like I was going to build it up to that point. So I apologize for just jumping right into that heaviness. Let me first thank the OA Academy for asking me to share the Vision for You special edition. I'm honored by this illustrious and prestigious service opportunity. Finally, I've been anointed, and with all humility, I say I've arrived. I just got to say that, like, you know, I haven't grown out of my fight for, you know, recognition, acknowledgement, prestige. I like that word, prestige. Prestige is defined as high respect and admiration gained through success, quality, or skill. And haven't I been guilty of seeking prestige in program, right? Like, it's a prestigious honor. You know, I say that jokingly, but on a real level, I use levity and humor to expose truth. And the truth is, like, you know, there's still a part of me that thinks that, you know, if you're speaking on Vision for You, there's a level of prestige in that. You know, all the greats have spoken and led here, and I'm walking through their hallowed halls. And I am also guilty of using the varnish of humility, like having a varnish of humility to cloak wanting approval and recognition, right? Like we call that humble bragging. And so I just want to joke about it because, like, it's the truth. It's the truth. I am very much a work in progress. And I'm not where I was. I'm not where I was. I've grown. The fight for prestige, the fight for recognition and admiration has lessened, but it ain't gone. It ain't gone. A true story related to that, around 3 years of recovery, I was the keynote speaker for the OA birthday party. And, you know, keynote, oh my God, that's a big deal. I'm a keynote speaker, you know? And I believe, like, if you were a keynote speaker, similar to this, like, I believe if you were a keynote speaker, you were the creme de la creme. You were somebody. And this is, I mean, we joke about it in program, but wanting to be somebody in program, right? Like, that's, you know, that's like being the mayor of the insane asylum, so to speak. But, you know, like, I so get it. Like, now I have compassion for that part of me. Part of the surrender to that. Surrender to that reality is, look, none of us came in here, or at least the people that I know, we didn't come in here on a winning streak. I know for a lot of my life, I didn't want to be me. And a lot of my life, it didn't feel good to be me. You know, I fought life. I felt like I was at war with life early. I found circumstances, people, places disappointing. You know, and I felt like life was a tragedy for a long time. And that was part of what drove me and motivated me to try to change things. I mean, it could be, who knows, it could be a litany of things, but, you know, I felt like I came in for, I didn't like my life in the circumstances of my life early. And then it's like I come to program and I get some love. You do get a little recognition when, you know, you're recovering and you get those cheers and you get that, you know, you just get a different experience, right? And you start to feel the light. And that becomes an addiction too. And that becomes, at least for me, it became a vehicle to get that self-love, to get that confidence. Like maybe I can know the big book more. But let me demonstrate to you how much I know of the big book. Maybe I can, if I, you know, lead workshops, that's where I'll get it. Speak on Vision for You, that's where I'll get it. I'll take my little 3 minutes of time to show you, you know, how well I'm doing, how I'm doing it the right way. So when I was asked to be the keynote speaker, like in all credit to me, I knew it was going to be a humility hit. You know, I did have the awareness that, you know, perhaps this is not going to be what I think it is. Like, and I did run it by my sponsor, which is, so to my credit, I did do those things. And what an experience, because, you know, it was great. I carried the message. And then afterwards, like, I felt like I was showered with love and applause. It was something that, you know, I secretly or not so secretly fought for, like I said. And, you know, when I got off that stage, it was just like the whole weekend people were congratulating me and saying how much I helped them. And, you know, I'm getting all these accolades. And then I had the realization that it was valueless currency. It was monopoly money. Meaning that weekend of the birthday party, I had more than my fair share of acknowledgement, recognition, and praise, adoration, and love from others. And it didn't translate into more love for myself. It didn't translate into contentment within myself, any peace inside. To the contrary, I felt the opposite effect of deep self-loathing and loneliness. It was a terrible sense of isolation. And I felt so undeserving and so unworthy. And that experience taught me, it taught me a little thing about humility. And ultimately, I was given the inspiration that, oh, this isn't for me. Whatever my story, my experience had inspired in others, it wasn't for me. It was like, this is for God. This is for the program to show what's possible when I surrender and I stop that fight. So I share that just as maybe that's helpful to someone. Because I know that was a big transition for me in my recovery. That was a big milestone going through that experience. And it was the beginning of a shift in my posture towards recovery in life, a shift in my position where, like, I simply wish to be helpful to those who are affected. I don't have to be a guru. I don't have to be a somebody in order to make an impact. Like, all I have to do is be helpful. And that's on page 88 in the big book, XIV. It also taught me I merely have found an approach that's worked for me. That's page 86 in the big book. Like, I'm simply a sick man trying to get better. I think there's so much humility in that short sentence. And like I said, I didn't always have this humility. You know, in my earlier iterations of recovery, I was on a crusade to win people over to the right side, the right way to do it. I found myself in a meeting one day at about, I want to say it was like 2.5 years. It was happening over a period of time where I was growing more isolated in one of the regular meetings that I was going to. And I was in a fight with that meeting because they didn't have, quote unquote, real recovery. Right? They, you know, it was in one of those meetings where they didn't talk a lot about the big book. And I used every opportunity, every share that I had to try to shape the meeting in my image. I just laugh at, you know, these ways that I thought I had to get through life. I was, you know, it was a sobering realization when I realized I was a recovery snob. I was on a mission to show you that I was doing it the right way and I knew better than you. Like, that was just this theme of, like, this just this constant superiority. I know the big book. I know what's right. And, like, you should be doing it my way. And this is the, you know. And quite honestly, that's, like, what kind of, it motivated me to listen to Vision for You early in the early days, because it was like, oh, the Vision people are doing it the right way. And if I do it like the Vision people, then that means that I'm doing it the right way. Like, I'm gonna share honestly with y'all. I'm gonna tell you the truth. My sponsor, he drilled into me a long time ago. He was like, if you're gonna be out here sharing and speaking, like, leading workshops, and you better show the whole story. You better give the whole picture, because I was guilty also of cultivating a certain image and projecting a certain image, so you would like me, so you would love me. So later, I learned page 89, working with others. Don't start out as an evangelist or a reformer. Unfortunately, a lot of prejudice exists. You'll be handicapped if you arouse it. Right? I was in working with others. When I did a deep study of working with others, it really shifted. It shifted a lot in me. And just that simple sentence, like, I realized, why am I trying to evangelize and reform my way? Let's take what I want to do right now. This is the group participation section of my share. And I would like you to join me in this if you can. It's a simple exercise. if you can. If you're driving, like I wouldn't advise you do this, but if you're sitting in the comfort of your own home, close your eyes with me. Just close your eyes with me. And what I want you to do is clench your fists. Clench your fists as hard as you can. Clench it as hard as you can, as long as possible you can. Hold it really tight until you can't anymore and release it. This was an inspiration that I received a few weeks ago. And this was prior to when I was asked to share here. It was a moment where I was fighting a circumstance in my life. And there was a moment where I felt internally that I had stopped fighting. And there was a shift. And I didn't realize that I was so spiritually clenching like that fist until I was granted the release. And it was such a relief to spiritually let go and to have awareness that I had let go, and awareness of like, oh, that's what, when I'm engaged in self-will, when I am trying to drive something, it feels like that clenched fist. And it was a gift to realize, oh, that's the experience of, you know, I hear people say, you know, turning my will over to the care of God. Like, I actually had the visceral feeling on a soul level of what it meant to turn my will and my life over to the care of God and turn it over. And to be candid, the circumstances, I'm working for an organization right now and I'm doing great work. I'm being told that I'm doing great work. I truly believe, like I have a confidence in my ability that I never had before in my work. And I'm delivering tangible, like my result on how it's impacting the organization I work for is tangible, visible, it is recognized. Not that I'm seeking that at work. Or that I thought. And I found myself being increasingly more disturbed that I'm not invited to the big table I got in my head that I should be in the strategy meetings. Not that I'm trying to, I genuinely don't think I'm trying to be like, you know, status guy, but I have a high opinion of my work. I try to deliver with high quality. I put a lot of effort in it. And I felt like that warranted me being in the leadership meetings. And that's also connected to, I think I should be paid more. I think I should be, you know, like Bill W., I fancied myself a leader, you know. I started to slip into that thinking. And I started to do the inventories on that, talk to people about it. And the release for me was the way that it manifested in my thinking and the change in my behavior. It was just like, stop fighting. Stop fighting that my career is, like, stop fighting my career, like where I'm at in life. What my career looks like. Just stop it. If this is what God wants it to look like, then this is what God wants it to look like. And I started praying for the ability to be grateful, genuinely grateful for where I'm at. I called up one of my brothers, and he said it was his one sentence. He said you're not doing too bad for a guy who couldn't wipe his ass. And that was the gut check that I needed. Because the story that I started with at 485 pounds, there were like I can't even enumerate the years that my disease prevented me from showing up how I show up now. I did that my previous organization a disservice. I was out on illness leave for almost a year and a half because of this disease. Let me finish how that day would go, that Monday would go at 485 pounds. So when I got into the office in the morning after being out of breath, and I would turn, I had arranged my cubicle to where my back was to all the other cubicles. And I would put on my noise canceling headphones, because I didn't want to be bothered with people saying good morning in the morning. And there were many days where I wouldn't speak to anyone. And if somebody said good morning, they could just feel me seething with bother and anger and depression. And that was my influence on my team. So that one sentence of you're not doing bad for a guy who couldn't wipe his own ass, it reminded me from where God has brought me. And all the miracles that have led up to where I'm at in my life. I've been wanting to fight less now. I don't want to be at war with life. Like, and do you know what that feels like? I know somebody knows what that feels like, just being at war with life. Like everything is displeasing to me. Going back to that meeting and, you know, me needing to reshape that meeting, I didn't finish that. I found myself increasingly bothered with everybody's share. You know, I was fighting to, you know, I took the secretary commitment and, you know, in my attempt to try to shape the meeting, I'm going to bring in the speakers who I listen to. You know, I'm gonna bring in people from the valley, the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, because that's where the real recovery is. These people on the West Side, they need to hear a different story. So I'm gonna bring in these speakers. You know, and like I said, I found myself becoming more isolated. I couldn't talk to the people because I was so critical and judgmental of them. And I felt, and it started to expand. It wasn't just that meeting. It was just an OA period. Like the only, it was just like I wasn't vision enough to be vision. In my home meetings, I wasn't feeling like I was connected to the, you know, I wasn't them. In my valley home meeting, it was everywhere. I was finding myself more isolated and isolated by my criticality, my superiority, my judgments. And then there was a moment where my sponsor, he said, stop fighting. He said, stop shooting the people that are in the foxhole with you. And I heard it. Because it gave me the imagery of war. And if I'm in the trenches of war and the enemy is on the other side shooting at me, imagine me shooting the people in the foxhole in the trenches with me. My own. And it was such a gift, that release. Like, these people are in the foxhole with me. We're all at war with something much greater than ourselves, and this is in the form of this disease. We're all sick people just trying to get better. So why am I so critical in attacking and tearing at these people? Why am I doing that instead of trying to be helpful, truly helpful, from a place of compassion, from a place of understanding and care? We all come here on the losing streak. We're all beat up. The disease has done that enough for me. In the AA 12 and 12, it talks about the rapacious predator that bleeds us of all self-sufficiency. We all come in here under the lash. What do I have to add to that? Why do I have to be a carrier energy of divisiveness instead of unity? I have more reason to be with you than against you. Found life to be unsatisfactory early. I was fighting the circumstances of my life for a long, long time, as long as I could remember. I remember something that I share in my, you know, when I grew up, like, I was always on food restriction. I still talk about this, and I still can feel little of the pain of, you know, my sister and brother got more food than me. And I would get less. And I still remember vividly that I would eat enraged. And my form of protest was to power through my meal faster than anyone else. And I would run to my room and cry and be in the darkness, because I didn't get as much food as everybody else did. You know, my weight was always a topic of discussion at family gatherings. You know, I wasn't raised by my mom. That was a source of frustration and disappointment in life. I didn't get to experience life like I saw other kids experience life, because I was fat. I just wanted to be normal. I just wanted to do what other little boys did. I just wanted to have the experience that they had. So, you know, having that and coming in the program, you know, I fought this thing for a long time. You know, number one, it was like I fought that I was powerless over food. Unmanageability. I didn't even know, like, I really understand what that truly meant. I mean, I knew, you know, and then it was like it took years for me to really come to an acceptance that, oh, okay, there's powerless over food. Now it's like, okay, my life is unmanageable. What does that even mean? I didn't even gather that. I've been coming around since I was, you know, 16, left for a little bit, came back at 19. I didn't know what unmanageable, meaning that, like, I can't manage my life. Like, as a life manager, I'm not doing a great job at that, and that I need direction and guidance to manage my life? Like, what? Okay, so then more years of pain go by, and all right, so now I'm open to the possibility I'm not probably the best life manager. And then the acceptance of that I need a spiritual solution. Yeah, they don't. What? Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow someday we will control and enjoy, that I will control and enjoy my drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or present maybe has to be smashed. Page 30. Like I said, I just wanted to be like other people. Why do I have to have this thing? I was never like other people. Or maybe I am like other people, because there's a lot of people with addiction that they just don't see it. I don't know. I know my family, there's a lot of addiction. But, you know, not many people have the experience of eating to the point where they're sick and throwing up when they're kids. Not many people have the experience of eating themselves to 485 pounds and wanting to kill themselves. And for me, I needed every compulsive bite to get to the point where I could fully surrender, where I could fully concede. And honestly, like, I don't know if that's a choice that I could have made earlier. I don't know. Like, I know several guys in our men's group who have died because of this. I know people who've died as a result of this disease. Boaz, Murray, Mark, Joe. I know people who have literally died as a result of this disease. And I could only, like, I think that moment of confession, for me, it was beyond my choice. It was like God gave me that. And I went through a period in recovery where I felt like survivor's guilt. It was almost like a version of survivor's guilt, because it was like, why me? Why did I get that gift of confession? And these other guys couldn't, they just could not see this way of life. And, you know, the fight isn't, I do want to acknowledge that the fight isn't always bad. I think when it's aligned with God's will, when God is using my fight as an agent of change, an example of that is in early recovery. This time around, my pink cloud points had expired. And It was a dog fight every day to get sober and to stay sober. It's been the hardest thing that I've ever done in my life. I found this quote, page 79, Big Book. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. Seeing the tendrils of disease, that was my thoughts on that. Like, the disease, just like an octopus or something, like some type of creature that just wants to wrap itself around me and hijack my thinking and drive me into the disease, right? Like, it took an amazing amount of fight to not go back to the darkness of the disease in those early days. And God used that. It was like, I needed just there was just a myopic focus where it was just like, just get through this day soberly. Whatever you got to do to just get through this day soberly. I needed that. And like Bill W., like, you know, he talks about being hit with waves. Let me get that exact quote. Page 15, I was not too well at the time, and I was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It was a design for living that works in rough going. I know that experience. Early recovery. I'm shaking. At 485 pounds, my routine, let me finish that day, that Monday off. I would starve the whole day because I didn't want people to see me in public. I would just sit at my desk, literally, I would go to the restroom when I needed to only. And then, you know, I would go back. And then as soon as 3:30 hit, I was out of there. And on the route back, you know, I was picking up. We have a place in LA called Fat Burger. I was picking up my Fat Burger. I was picking up my donuts. I was collecting all my donuts and the desserts and with the Fat Burger and the two Fat Burgers and the large fries. And, you know, they had the big fries. And I would collect all that and then return back to my cave. And then I would gorge myself. That would be my evening. And that was my routine every day. So in early recovery, I knew, like, I would just drive from work at 3:30. I would drive to Santa Monica, which is on the west side of town. And I would just hang out in Santa Monica near the meeting. Like, until it started at, like, 6 o'clock. Because I didn't want to risk having to go through that gauntlet of food, even just that trip, you know, that muscle memory, like of going, stopping and getting food and going home. Like, I just wanted to break that. And the best that I could do was just go to the area around the meeting and hang out. If that meant just sitting in my car, going to the beach, whatever I had to do, just hang out near the meeting. Some nights as soon as I got home, I would just put myself to sleep at 6:30. I would go to bed early, or I would make calls. I would text. I went to a meeting every day for 100 days. You know, I did anything that I could just to put a little distance between me and that first compulsive bite. And assume, you know, and just a little bit of prayer asking God to remove the obsession. That wasn't enough for me. I had to get out as soon as that thought came in and I started to get that itch, I needed to get out and get into action and do something to try to put distance between me and that first compulsive bite. So when Bill talks about he's scrambling to find somebody to help, I get that. And that's how God used that fight. I have 3 minutes left. I can't believe it. So just to let you know that I haven't graduated, I just want to get current a little bit in this last 3 minutes. I still have fight in me. Some things, and lately what I've been trying to do is in meditation, I've been trying to capture that feeling of balling up my fists and unclenching, trying to practice that in meditation around situations. I still fight my partner. When it comes to, I fight love. I fight, I can feel myself clench up when, she acknowledges something good that I did. I feel myself clench up when she shows affection to me, when she shows love to me. And that's something that I've been, in the 3 years we've been together. And it's not just with her. It's been my journey in recovery to learn, like, not keep people at a distance and to allow it in, to allow people to care for me, to allow people to love me. I can still feel myself clench up into a fist inside spiritually. And I ask God to please help me with that. Please help me let it in. Please help me see myself the way others see me. Please, let me see myself the way you see me. I just, please just help me let the love in. Yeah, that fight of not wanting to be close, that's a big one for me. I was recently fighting with, I had been following my food plan and practicing my food plan to the T as my dietitian prescribed, and I was starting to gain weight and program. And how are people going to view me? And are they going to judge my recovery as being less potent? And, fighting that my food plan is no longer just eating in a way to stay sober. Now it's just like, oh, I'm getting older. My activity is less than it was. Mainly getting older, my food plan has to adjust. I can't just, it has to adjust. There needs to be adjustments made as a result of, I was fighting that. So, fighting that exercise is no longer an option. It's something that I have to do. So hopefully I shared something that was helpful, and I think that's my time. I think that was 45 minutes. And I'll wrap it there.
All right. Thank you so very much for all that you offered to us this morning. Thank you for your inspiring, captivating, and thought-provoking presentation this morning. Another gem for the archives. Thank you so much. Share ID for today, 23,666. That's 23666. Always contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so do stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to a question-answer segment. You can pose a question to Olay by pressing star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter. And, of course, questions only, please. One per customer. Who'd like to pose a question today?
Jennifer G., California. Loretta H.
Loretta H.
Pete B.
Pete.
Kiana W. in Ohio.
Is that Kiana? Okay.
Elaine S. New York.
Elaine.
Christina J.
Christina. Star one to unmute if you'd like to pose a question.
Mary Lee.
Mary Lee. Okay, this is our list thus far. We have Jennifer G., Loretta H., Pete B., I believe Kiana W., Elaine F., Christina J., and Mary Lee R. Let's get started with Jennifer. Jennifer, star one to unmute.
Sorry about that. Hi, this is Jennifer G., compulsive, recovered compulsive overeater in California. Thank you so much. I'd like to hear about what your Mondays look like now.
Yeah, so tomorrow, I'm pretty sure that before I get out of bed, I'm going to start meditation. For me, like I know some people have a corner and some people have a chair. For me, it was like a practice of, like, I literally sit up in my bed and I get right to it. And I start doing my breathing. I set my timer. I'll do some prayer. I'll do my morning readers. And then I'll get into some writing. And that's usually how my morning starts. Then I'm going to get breakfast. I have a sober meal. Then I get ready for work. And usually during work, I work from home for the majority of the time. I can take calls during my hours. And I have a type of work where I kind of zone out and I'm just doing the work. And then I have a couple of sponsees who will call later in the day. And I'll help them through some things. We'll get into the big book. And then usually after my last sponsee, I'll get to helping my partner with prepping our meal or dinner. And then I'll probably start the sprinkler because our manual sprinkler because our sprinkler system is out. So I'm trying to restore the green grass. And then me and my partner will be looking at the wire. And that's, we have our hour of watching the show together. And that's probably how my Monday will go tomorrow.
Thank you, Jennifer, for your question. Loretta H., your turn.
Thank you, Leah, and thank you, Ole, and all of you. You're saving my life, coverage. In North Carolina, Loretta H., Ole, what I heard from your share is one of my favorite passages, our darkest past in God's hands, our greatest asset. And you also said that you are able, especially with vision, to get more clear on how to work life on life's terms. I'd like to know what those ideals and ideas, what are some of the, from what vision practices, because you said you found it was the right way. So, and with that, I pass. Thank you again for the share that is saving my life.
Yeah, what I meant was, you know, because I've been through the Joe and Charlie workshops. You know, I've gone through the big book studies, and I've done all the different types of inventories and the formats and the sheets, and you know, that's what I meant by like the right way. In this idea that, oh, that's the right way. And it's the right way and the only way. Instead of, oh, this is the way that I found for me that works. I can't say for someone else, hey, you need to do it like this. You need to do it the way that I deem is the right way, and project. Like, I don't know. It's like I'm trying to control somebody else's experience, and just this rigidity around how someone should approach program. I just lately I found for me, or not lately, but I've just found for me, it doesn't feel good when I'm in that place of trying to control somebody else's experience and trying to push something on somebody else. That's the best way that I can explain it in the moment.
Thank you, Loretta H., for your question. Pete B., you're up.
Thanks, Leia. Thanks, Leia, for your service. Thanks, Olay. That was deep and heavy and well thought out. Really appreciate the preparation that you put into it. So my question is, on page 85, it says that the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us so long as we stay in fit spiritual condition. Can you talk about how that has manifested in your life today?
So I haven't used food in a damaging and destructive way in 10 years. And I can say that without a doubt in my mind. I haven't used food in an unsober way in 10 years. Now, does that mean that I haven't saw, you know, some new food product and thought, oh, that looks really good? Or has there ever been moments where that I can't say that there have been moments where, you know, that there's been a call for the comfort of it, or I can't say that. Like I can't say that I'm without food thought for this whole 10 years. But has there ever been an overwhelming desire to use food in the way that I did? I've been relieved of that. That's the best way I can describe that.
Thank you, Pete, for your question.
Thank you.
Kiana W.
Hi, this is Kiana, recovered food overeater, compulsive overeater in Ohio. Thank you so much for your service. I have a question that you kind of answered already, but I wanted you to expound upon it. How did you or God remove the character defect of judgmentalism as related to the people in the meetings, like the quote-unquote maybe not-so-recovered meetings? And then what's the difference between being used like to help rescue people who are struggling in the food in those meetings? Thank you.
Oh, that's a great question. It took, you know, so whenever there's been a release for me, it's usually preceded by a lot of pain. And like I said, you know, I was becoming isolated, and it started to become painful to be critical of others. It just started to become, and I don't even know how to describe, it's not the type of pain where, you know, like, I kick my toe on the edge of the bed, or, you know, I get cut by a knife. Like, it's not a pain like that. It's just, it becomes so loud in my head. Like, that superiority was becoming so loud in my head, and it was just becoming miserable to be in my own skin. And of course, like, you know, just, I didn't talk a lot about this, but of course I did like the inventory on it. I had to put this down on paper. And sometimes I had to do inventory on it multiple times. I talked about it openly and got honest with others. And so I did the prayer on it, and, you know, it started with like just keeping my mouth shut. Like I went through a period where I stopped sharing, where if it was going to be a share that was going to be used in a way of trying to attack someone else's method, or, and I just literally stopped sharing and keep my mouth shut. And like it started with that, or it started in ways where, you know, I would deliberately connect with those that I was critical of and see how I could be of service to them. Or it was, you know, let me take the less shinier ways of being a service. Like, let me put away the trash. Let me put the, like, I was deliberately finding ways to humble myself. And I was getting those inspirations to do that. So that's kind of how I feel like God breadcrumbed me out of that, or grew me up in that way. It took deliberate action, for sure. And to combat that disease. The second part of your question, I forgot the second part of your question. I'm sorry. Can you just restate the second part?
The second part was, what's the difference between that, like being a judgmental and being quiet, versus someone really needs to hear a message because they need to be rescued? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, like, not to be a contrarian, but like, who am I to determine what a person needs? Yeah, like, I can see a person suffering, you know. But who am I to, like, I didn't even save me. So what makes me think that I can save someone else? And that's a hard thing to accept, right? Like, I'm limited power. God is in control of just like I needed a confluence of situations and circumstances to get me to where I could hear it. They need that. And like, I don't know where they are in their journey. I mean, all I can do is be an example in the sense of like sharing my experience, strength, and hope, and continuing to recover and showing up and being a service the way I can. And ultimately, like, God is going to put that together for them. I mean, it's taken really a long time, like, to get to a place like where I truly believe that. And I've had experiences that have shaped me in that way. I didn't get to tell one of my sponsee stories, but basically, like, it really is in God's control. I can't determine that for another person. But I can show up and continue to recover and do, you know, continue to seek in my relationship and continue to share that as honestly as I can, that experience with y'all, and find ways to be a help where I can.
Thank you, Kiana, for your question. Next up, we have Elaine S.
Hi, this is Elaine S. from New York, and thank you both for the service that you're doing. It's just amazing. And Ori, I've met you a couple of times. You came to Santa Barbara. I'm living in New York now, but you came to Santa Barbara a couple of times with the sober eating workshop, and I think the first time you were fairly new in program. So, you know, I've seen a little bit of your, you know, your recovery growing, your growth in your relationship with God. And my question is, I wonder if you feel the way I feel, which is that I'm grateful that I'm a compulsive eater, because as much as it has caused me pain in my life, I wouldn't have the peace and ease that I have in my life today. I wouldn't have the relationships I have. I wouldn't have the gratitude that I'm feeling. And I wonder if you feel that gratitude also, that, you know, that it's a good thing, that God gave you a gift when God made you a compulsive eater. And I pass.
You know, Elaine, like I've heard people express that over the years, and like I hope I do get to that place. I really do. Like I think I'm more in a place of I value this way of life right now because it's not what it was. Like I'm grateful to be free. I'm grateful. I'm just grateful to be free and everything that comes with being free. I'll say it like that, and I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Elaine. Christina J., your question, please.
Good morning, Leah. Thank you for your service. Thank you for this talk today. I love the fight thing, you know, and all my life I learned how to fight things, and especially when they were uncomfortable emotions. And that's where I'm at. I'm really working with emotional stuff. And God is showing me two things right now that are damn painful. Because they were ways I coped, and they were things I learned from my parental units. And I took those ways of being and doing, and they were very unhealthy, very unhealthy. And they're coming up in big ways, and they sucker punch me in the gut. And I know about the 10 steps and 11 steps, but they keep coming up. And I'm wondering, you know, I have my ways of surrendering those based on big book practices and such. But I'm wondering what your immediate response is when you feel that, you know, almost shame about these bad character defects. And I know we don't have to feel that, but, you know, I'm shocked at some of the things God is showing me that have been in my character through the years. So how do you surrender and see God's gift in that moment of, you know what I'm saying here? And also, I just want to say, I love your description of, I had a sober breakfast. I love that. That's so beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for your share. Look forward.
Yeah, you know, this may sound like I'm going off the reservation just a little, like, and you know, there's professionals who are more skilled and knowledgeable in this area, but like I've read books and, you know, psychology and neuroanatomy and I think like these defects of character, whatever way we want to label those things, I think some things are like just knowing like the brain and how it's plasticity, I think that's the term, and how experiences are physically written into the physiology of my brain, and how my neurons fire and the pathways that are formed in my brain, like that inform like how I react emotionally to life. Like some of these things are so, I just feel like they're so entrenched in my physiology. They're beyond a place of consciousness. And like for me, like reading all that material just, you know, reinforces like the belief that I'm powerless over these things. I'm powerless over the physiology of my brain and how memories were imprinted on literally like how my brain physically formed. Like it's so beyond my control. And, you know, in the 12 and 12, it says, like, on page 40, it says, then it is explained that other steps of the AA program can be practiced with success only when step 3 is given a determined and persistent trial, right? Like, this is something that I have to practice and practice and practice. And just 10 years of recovery and practicing in this way of life is not going to eliminate, you know, 30 years of showing up in a different way and my brain forming as a result of that. Like it's impossibility. And I don't know if I'm ever eradicate everything out of me, like these maladjustments. But I do have faith that if I continue to practice this way of life and work this program in community and continue to learn from y'all and see it demonstrated and continue to practice it, like over time, it has gotten better. And I form new pathways in the brain that fire differently. And I have a fighting chance to like see life become something different.
Thank you for that.
Thank you for your question, Christina J. Mary Lee R., your turn.
Good morning. Thank you so much. This is Mary Lee R. in Oregon. First question is your partner in recovery, and along with that, do you have a way that you share your program and then are able to keep your own boundaries to where you want them, if that makes any sense? Thank you.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. It's like, how do I stay in my lane? You know, how do I stay on my side of the street? And you know, I don't always do the best job of that. You know, so sometimes I think the best spiritual action that I can do is just keep my mouth shut. You know, sometimes I just shut it, just shut your mouth. And sometimes it's hard. But, you know, one thing that with my partner, I respect her recovery before we even were together. Like, I respected her recovery. And, you know, she's no slouch in how she approaches program. And you know, like, so I don't question her seeking, and like, I really do respect her program. So like, I respected it enough to know that, you know, she's doing the work that she needs to do. And of course we share it together. You know, just this morning, you know, we were doing our meditation together. We do that at least, like for the last couple of months, we've been doing that together. We listen to, we try to listen to each other's shares when we share and support each other that way. Our life is recovery. When we go on trips to places, we're going to see mutual friends, and yeah, we definitely share that. But yes, it's still a challenge to just keep my mouth shut sometimes. And sometimes my writing, it's just simple prayers like, God, help me be kind, you know, help me be nice. And it's hard to like, well, what love does she need? Man, that's one of the greatest right now. It's something that's driving me towards growth every day, is improving that relationship with her, or continue to grow that relationship. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mary Lee R. We still have time for a few more questions. If you have a question, star 1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Judith R.
Natalie C.
Judith R.
Donna M.
D. Natalie. Jana.
Ramona A.
And Ramona. Okay, that should be. Okay, go ahead with your question, Judith R., please.
Thank you, Leah. Good morning. Thank you so much for stressing your character defect of wanting everybody to do the program the same way you do it, because I've been doing that for 40 years, thinking I knew the only way. So I would love to hear an example of someone that you had pity on and didn't force your way on them.
Um, So, and I'll tell the story right now, because it was a great learning lesson for me. One of my sponsees, I've been working with him the longest. He went through a period in his recovery where he started to relax the standards of what had got him to where he was in recovery. And he wasn't showing up for our calls. He was like, ghosting. It was becoming hard to contact him. He wasn't going to his meetings. And he was essentially slipping out the back door. He was, and I was growing really concerned. I was growing really concerned with his behavior. And I knew where it would end up. And, I would talk to my sponsor about it and get guidance on how to deal with it. I was, trying to be as persuasive as I could to convince him that he needed to get back to doing what we do. I was even considering talking to his wife to see if she could try to, rouse him from his lethargy. And it got to a place where in my inventory around this, my fear was him going back out. And yes, there was a part of me caring for his recovery, but there was also a fear of, what does it say about me as a sponsor if he goes back out? There's always that part of me that has an emotional investment for me in some way. I know in a lot of my sponsorship relationships in early recovery, we're driven by, well, I need to win people over. I need to get people sober so I could feel better about me. And in my sponsor's relationships initially, like, it was a lot of, you need to get sober, so, if you don't, then therefore I'm inferior as a sponsor. Right. So, and that was a humbling realization too. And that was kind of, these dirty little things that I discovered about me and my behavior is like, oh, it was a lot about, I wanted to have these notches on my belt that, these are my sponsees and look how they're flourishing and the great and powerful Ore has done somehow. So in this situation, like, again, going back to, I stopped chasing him. I learned that I can't want it more than someone else. And working with others, they talk about that. And I also learned it's not my job to strong arm him into recovery. I don't have that power. And really, that's what I really don't want to feel is that fear, like that fear of inferiority, that fear of the realization that, oh, I'm powerless over another person's recovery. Whether they recover or don't recover, if somebody recovers, that's not on me either, right? Like, so I'm not winning anything. That's God. That's evidence of God's work, not Ori's work. No matter how persuasive or clever or, however way I package this big book for them, all that's well and great, but ultimately it comes down to that person's relationship with God, and that's a humbling place to be. I'll leave it there.
Thank you, Judith R., for the question. Natalie, your turn.
Yes, Natalie here. I have a question. You mentioned, getting to work, putting on your headphones, and just wanting to be left alone. I can relate to basically just, whenever in public places, just wanting to be left alone and not participate in the human race. Now that I'm abstinent, my desires are changing, and I'm finding that all of a sudden I want to connect. I want to belong. Do you have any experience with, you know, living your whole life isolating in plain sight, and then now wanting to connect, wanting to belong. And I'll pass.
Absolutely, absolutely. I did work in another program around it's called sexual, social, emotional anorexia, and this need to withdraw and to isolate and keep the world at an arm's distance. And I've done I've done a lot. And specifically, like in the workplace, my sponsor told me, he was like you don't get to take out your anger on others anymore. He's like, you got to quit this. It was like a moment where it was like a gut check. He's like, you got to quit this. He's like, you can no longer take your anger out on, like, no one deserves that. And it was like a wake up moment for me. And I started to change how I showed up in the office. And I would do silly things like, you know, in the morning, even though I didn't feel like it, I would try it on and I would over exaggerate. Hey, how's it going, guys? Like, you know, it felt like that was over exaggerating this ability to connect. Like I made it every morning. It was a discipline of mine. I switched the position of my cubicle. I made it a point to talk to everybody. And like I said, I would over exaggerate. So, because it felt so weird and it felt so mechanical, I started to change, like I looked for ways that I could help the team. Like I would, you know, and it's so interesting because I actually start to become a team lead, like a de facto team lead. And I even went to the extent of, after I made my amends to some of the guys or a majority of my team, I made a direct amends to in both, like one-on-one and just how I changed my behavior and how I performed with the team. But I actually did, nobody had ever done this, but I did a 360 feedback as part of my career development, where I wrote a letter to each person and asked them to provide feedback on how I could improve as a coworker. And people were shocked about that. People were so shocked that I had opened myself up in that way. And it actually brought me closer to my team. And they gave honest feedback. And a lot of the feedback was around they wanted to be closer. And they wanted me to be more open. And I really improved on that. So that's how that changed in the workplace. And then in my life, look, there's a lot of time where I want to go back into the withdrawal and I isolate, but my life is set up in a way where, like, I'm forced to participate. I have to participate. And, you know, and I actually like it. It's something that's taking time, but like you, I want to be connected. I think that's like, God wants me to be connected. God doesn't want me to be what I used to be. He's given me too many tools and capabilities and skill sets, and he's built me for connection. I really do firmly believe that God has built me for connection. I'm meant to be a part of the world and a part of community. You know, if I were to tell myself that like 10 years ago, that guy's head would have exploded. I've unlearned some things about me. I think that's the best I can do on that one.
Leia, we don't hear you.
Thank you. Thank you, Natalie, for your question. And our final question for today comes from Jana M.
Hi, Leia. This is Ramona A. in Vermont, recovered compulsive eater. And thank you all for being there this morning. It's been a really, really good morning and session. So my question is that you spoke in the beginning or somewhere about not being given as much food as the other kids, you know, and how that hurt. And I was the only one in my family who had this illness. And I remember at age 9 being taken to the doctor and being told, you know, this is the diet you have to be on. And ever after that, my mother would ask me. I was in a farm family, and there was always homemade delicious desserts. She would look at me first and say, you don't want any of this, do you, Mona? And I'd have to say no. And that always left, I've forgiven because I know they.
You know, Mona, in the interest of time, can you pose your question, please?
Question, yes. Have you,
thank you.
Found a way, have you found a way to release the pain from that?
Yeah, I think for me, people are born into this world with a myriad of circumstances, right? And challenges, whether it's mentally or physically. And this is mine. You know, some people have to deal with autism, or or some people deal with, you know, clinical depression, or some people are born into this world with, you know, they don't have all their limbs, or, you know, there's all type of challenges people are born into this world with. And I think this is just, you know, I have my version of it. And not to equate it to, not like, I don't want to diminish or minimize any other person's experience. And I don't have that experience. I just that's the way I look at it, though. It's like, thank God that I have a way out, and thank God I have a method to deal with this that I have. And that's okay.
Thank you, Ramona, for your question, and thanks to all who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you to our speaker, O'Reilly. Thank you so much for such a compelling and profound presentation this morning. We appreciate all that you gave to us today. The share ID for today's presentation, 23,666. That's 23666. And we're going to close now from page 164, found in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you.